Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Whirl with Merle, and I'm your host, Merle Exit, here in New York City. It's 7 o'clock p.m., and it's not so bad outside. It's, you know, like, well, it's cold, but not disgustingly cold. I just got back. Oh, God gracious. I just got back from Salem, Massachusetts. Actually, I did a whole tour north of Boston and some other areas that I went to, but the last place I spent some of today and all of yesterday in Salem, and the beginning of my tour was in some other areas in North Boston, north of Boston. But I have to tell you, this is going to be a heck of a show. See who's going to call in. Well, first of all, I was supposed to take the 5 o'clock plane from Boston, the shuttle from Boston to LaGuardia, and it would have taken about an hour. And it turned out that I was able to get the 3 o'clock plane. I said, great, you know, and I get in at 4. Then it takes me forever to get my luggage because the luggage comes in, or I don't think mine came in, and then they started telling everybody that it was at another carousel. So I went down to that carousel, long walk to that carousel, to find out, oh, no, mine is at where I started in the beginning. And I claimed it, and now I call the car service. And the car service says, you have to wait, and we'll call you. Well, okay. So we're now getting to 5 o'clock, when I would have come in the first place. And I'm trying to find out, you know, when I'm going to get this car service. So car finally pulls up. I think it must have been maybe 5:15. Okay, there was a lot of traffic. And this guy, first I asked what the price is. And, you know, they have to call in the price. And I noticed, like, going there, it was $23 to go to the airport, and coming back was $24. So it's the thing with car services, and I don't know if all of them do it, but it's like they, you know, this particular one called Blue Lane, it's like they make up the price each time, you know. But now I get, we're going, and the driver decides there's too much traffic and takes me at least about five miles out of the way of getting to my house, saying the traffic is better. But then I don't get to the house. Now, mind you, the show starts at 7. I'm getting to the house. It's like 10 to 6. And then I hand him money, and I said to him, telling him how much change he should give me, and he tells me he has no change. This is his first fare of the evening. And he says, wait, I'll get change, and proceeds to ask people in the cars, like right on the block as they're coming down there, if anybody has change, if it's 10. Of course, I got to get into the damn house to do the show. And I finally have like a couple of singles and give him wind up giving me exactly the fare, and I said, I got to get inside. You know, I mean, this was like, it couldn't have gotten more absurd. It really did, but I don't even want to go into that. I just got home barely in time. And to find out, you know, I have an email giving me a list of who's coming on, and then another email saying the tourism person hasn't heard back from yet. So should be quite an interesting show. I think I might have two of them coming on, and I don't even know if someone's coming on within the half an hour. But so before I get to, you know, I have to do my favorite commercial. I don't want to eat too. So, Barb, if you think you're hungry, yes. What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale. Yeah, I would like them at the right now. Yeah, you can get them at brownies.com, and now they're enrobed in the chocolate as well. Oh, my God. But I did get some. I did bring back some chocolates. Yep, I did. Because I went into, well, I'll get into the itinerary, but one of the places, and I don't even know if they're going to call in, but I'll say as much as I can about this place. We went in, I went to this candy store. The heck's the name of it? Ye Old Pepper Company Limited, and spelled company with I-E instead of Y-I-E. And so what it is about this place, it's supposed to be, I guess it's the oldest candy company. Well, I'll tell you what this is. Before I get to the chocolates, which I'm saving because I'm going to have to eat something, you know, normal before I have dessert, but a couple of the candies I have, one is called the famous Salem Gibraltars, and I'll just, it says early in the 19th century, the Spencer family sailed from England to Massachusetts. When they lost all their worldly goods in a shipwreck and arrived in a rather destitute condition, the neighbors in the north part of Salem offered assistance. Yeah, I'll take candy, sure. Okay. It became known that Mrs. Spencer was a candy maker, so a barrel of sugar was donated. It was this barrel of sugar that laid the foundations of the now well-known Salem Gibraltar business. The pure, delicious Gibraltars at once became very popular. Mrs. Spencer bought a horse-drawn wagon, from which to peddle her wares throughout the streets of Salem and surrounding towns. Her son continued making and selling Gibraltars until he returned to England and sold the business to Mr. Pepper. This candy tradition is still being carried on by the Pepper Company today. Now, let's see what it's made of. This particular one I have, it says, it's billed as the first candy made commercially in America. And what I have is a peppermint Gibraltars. Let's see, in the ingredients. Sugar, water, cream of tartar, cornstarch, and oil of peppermint. I didn't have it yet. I didn't try it yet, but let's see. Oh, it's not soft candy. I just cracked. That wasn't my teeth. That was the... It's good. I can't think of it. It reminds me of something else, though. So it's not as hard as hard candy. Yeah, it's good. Then there was a second thing they have, an original thing. Pardon me for sniveling, but this is called Black Jacks. They were the first stick candies made and sold commercially. And they're made from black strap molasses, circa 1830. All natural, healthful, and delicious. Well, I don't know how healthful. I mean, it says ingredients, first ingredient is sugar. And it says corn syrup, molasses, and cream of tartar. And I did try it when I was there, and it's, well, it kind of reminds me of something to suck. Yeah, they suck. No. Like something to suck on, like instead of maybe rock candy, if you, you know, you need some, I suppose if you have, you know, molasses might have some characters or nutritional value. Who knows? But they were okay. Just give me the chocolate. The chocolate, they're using Merkins, which is good. That's using Merkins, with the, and the dark chocolate is called the Yucatan, real Yucatan chocolate. So it's a good grade of chocolate. And I have like chocolate-covered cranberries and stuff that I got. So that wasn't the first place I went to. Heavens knows. First thing I did, actually, was I checked into the Hawthorne Hotel. Now, this hotel's got like 89 rooms. And it says it's been the North Shore's gathering place for over three quarters of a century. Three quarters of a century. This sounds like a long time, you know, like, but then I think about, like, how old I am. And I guess I'm at least, like, about half a century. Wow. Yes, I think, let's see. It's named for author Nathaniel Hawthorne. No shit. Who spent his childhood, it's not, his name is not Nathaniel Hawthorne, no shit. I'm just commenting. Who spent his childhood in Salem. I see, that's why. Well, the hotel, I was told, by the way, that originally it was one of these hotels where they had all these, you know, small rooms, and then you went down the hall to the, you know, to use the bathroom. God forbid. Thank goodness they redid this entire hotel, because I like having my own bathroom, you know. So that's where I stayed. I had breakfast there this morning, and I had an omelet, a lobster and asparagus omelet. Yeah, I know, Barbie, it's starting to drool. I hope you ate something. And what did we do? Oh, we grabbed lunch at a place called, let's see, Red's, which is like the local kind of place to go. It was basic food, like, you know, not that anything was not good, but it's not a, you know, not a gourmet place. It's, you know, kind of local. What did I have? I had scallops. I can't say scallops. That's New York. at Scallops. And but what later on, I'm going to have a chef from one of the other restaurants that we went. I was with somebody from tourism, was taking me around, and so one of the chefs will be on later to talk about the menu, you know, and the restaurant. yeah. I should probably have a blackjack and suck on that. Now, I did witch stuff, but I want to save that for next to... What's the matter? Mallory? Mallory? Yeah, Mallory's here. Mallory, come in here. Come on in here. Come on in here. Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm on the radio. Okay. Well, why don't you like to sit next to me? Well, I can't come out because I'm on the radio right now. God bless her little heart. Anyway, get back to this. So, I want to get to all the witch kind of stuff next week. I'm doing the show on Tuesday due to the holidays. Because we have Hanukkah this weekend. Sunday night is the beginning of Hanukkah, or shall I call it Chanukah? What I'll do is on Tuesday I'll sing both Hanukkah and Christmas songs. How's that? I'll do it a cappella versus a cappella. So what I did today, I went to the Witch Museum, and so we're going to have somebody to talking about that whole thing about the past, witch trials and so on and so forth. And I'm going to have somebody, his name is Christian, who's going to talk about, he is a witch. So he's going to talk about that. And also my experience of there and going to the altar and doing a witchcraft type of thing. To get back to this. This is the second time actually that I was in Salem. But last month the whole trip that I did last month was like horrible, and because I don't want to say it all on the radio, but I took care of whatever had to be taken care of, and they brought me back up. And but while I was there last time, I went to the Peabody Essex Museum, and so I'm going to have somebody on later on from the Peabody Essex Museum, That'll be later today, and somebody from the trolley tour. Well, not just the trolley tour, but the specific one that I took last night was a one on the Christmas Carol trolley tour, which he'll explain when he comes on. And I'm gonna like take a break. I'm in the mood for music. Let's see. Where's the other one? Not the gift. Let's see. Let's do this one here. That'll dedicate this to tomorrow. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
like angel wings, like diamonds on the ground. Autumn leaves are gone now, winter winds blow cold, but I dance through December with your hand.
From Salem that was calling in. So if it's you, whoever it is, call on back. Let's see. I see a 9. It was a 978 area code. That's Salem. So by all means, I don't know. Anyway, let's get back to this. Salem. Oh, so. One place I went to that was kind of odd. It was, well, it wasn't that it was odd here. Let's see what I have on it. I went to the Witch Museum. Let's see. And the thing about it, I'm looking to see if I have this on here. Because the weird thing about the Witch Museum is that it's, I don't know why they call it, Salem Witch Museum. Let me see. It's not the Salem Witch Museum. I mean, Witch History Museum. That's what it's called. And it's really not. It's actually supposed to be the home of the judge or whatever who presided over the witch trials. So. you know, we get to see his house. I don't think they reconstructed. Maybe they did. I don't know. I'll have that person on next week. Well, anyway, whoever you are from Salem, please call back. It's not like they're... Let's see. Did I get an email? Nope. Let's go. Let's just make sure. Let's see. No. But I did get some emails. What was... Let's see. I love when I get the emails with some jokes. Well, it's funny marriage jokes. Okay. I didn't care for that one. Yeah. Tomorrow, by the way, anybody who... Okay. Let's just see who I... All right. I'm opening up the... Who do I got over here? Who's on the air here?
Well, hi there. This is April Swakonik from the Peabody Essex Museum.
Oh, okay.
Hi.
I was wondering, well, did you call in before? No, that was another phone number I saw.
No, I'm here, a little bit before 7:30.
Okay. Now, what happened was that I got an email basically telling me that people haven't heard from all these people.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, oh, okay, so I have a half an hour to kill.
Well, I'm here if you want me.
But... But then I had noticed, because what happens is I have a friend who listens to the show, and she'll listen to it like via like telephone kind of thing. So I'll see the phone number up there, and I'll ignore it because I know she's just listening, and I didn't realize that it wasn't her. Anyway, let's get to the Peabody Museum. Tell us all about it.
Well, okay. Well, I guess we're on the air then, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Fabulous. Well, the Peabody Essex Museum is the oldest operating museum in the country. We started up in 1799, believe it or not. And it started as a society of maritime sea captains and businessmen, basically people who were really involved in global trade. Salem, Massachusetts, where we're located, is a port town known for things other than witches. And the seafaring captains at the time were really interested in bringing back really interesting objects from around the world to show people what they were investing in, and also to show New England their connection to other parts of the world, something that we still try to do. That's a start. What else do you want to know?
I want to talk about some of the exhibits that are there.
Fantastic. Well, we have really strong exhibitions in a number of areas. We have a really strong Asian export, Chinese, Japanese, Korean exhibitions. We also have a really wonderful contemporary Indian, East Indian collections, and really wonderful shows here right now of that. We have a 200-year-old Chinese home here. It's the only example of domestic Chinese architecture in the whole continent that's here. It was fully deconstructed brick by brick and reconstructed here as part of the museum in 2003. So when people who used to live in a house in China come here to visit, they say things like, it doesn't look like my house, it is my house. And every detail, we completely reconstructed it, right down to the Maoist posters on the wall and to the shoe drying rack in the corner and the baby minder, which is basically a little barrel you stick your child in to keep them from being overly mobile. Anyway, in every tiny detail, their house was reconstructed here, so we're really proud of that. We also have just hired a brand new contemporary curator and a brand new curator of photography, our first of both that we've ever had in 200 years. So we're really excited about what they're going to be bringing to us over the next couple of years. And right now, and just tell me if I'm going on a bit there, Merle, we have a really beautiful exhibition called To the Ends of the Earth, Painting the Polar Landscape. And essentially, these are 50 paintings by really amazing artist explorers who traveled to the North and South Poles during the time when that was essentially tantamount to traveling to outer space. And it was the farthest a human being could go physically, metaphysically, spiritually. It was the absolute end of human experience. And a lot of them brought back either really brought back these amazing visions of these parts of the world, and they translated them into huge, monumental, romantic canvases or into works that they did in pastel because, you know, if you're painting on plein air in the Arctic, pretty much all you can get to work with your mittens and the freezing cold temperatures is pastel. Oil paint just congeals and solidifies. In fact, one explorer who got into a speck of trouble out there had to use his paint as caulk for a leaky boat because it was all they had, and it worked kind of like cement out in those elements.
Wow.
I know, it's incredible. The stories behind the paintings are really extraordinary, and we've had a really amazing reaction to this, like from the public and from critics as well. It's just a really beautiful exhibition, and it doesn't seem to matter at all that the weather is going to echo this very soon up in this part of the country. I don't know. I always wondered whether that would really add or detract, but it seems like people are really excited about it anyway. It seems like too much of a good thing, but actually everybody seems to be really happy to see the images because they're so beautiful, and most people will never go to these places. I mean, it seems like now we can just get in a helicopter and be dropped off and see a bunch of penguins. But in the past, you know, it was a really epic voyage to places that were utterly indomitable. And now they seem, despite their vastness, really very delicate with global warming and everything else that goes on. So it's really interesting to look at this place that essentially shrank before our eyes in so many different ways.
Mm. So this whole thing, it's all paintings.
Well, that's all paintings, but we have all kinds of things going on simultaneously. We'll be doing 17 exhibitions in this coming year.
Oh,
and right now, we really have a lot going on all at once. Right now, we also have a really beautiful exhibition of Japanese kabuki prints, which are really bright and vibrant, along with, you know, kabuki films of kabuki performances in Japan and their costumes and their makeup and the whole thing. We also have a wonderful, I think I mentioned before, wonderful contemporary paintings by Indian artists that we're really proud of, and we're looking forward to bringing a lot more of Indian art into the museum over the next year. In fact, we'll be having a big Indian festival in the spring. We have a really gorgeous collection of Native American art, especially contemporary Native American art. That's usually in situ here, and there's a lot to see. One exhibition we've been really thrilled with is one called Body Politics, Maori Tattoo Today, and that's an exhibition of gorgeous, huge, large-format photographs by the fashion photographer Hans Melleman, who took pictures of Maori people with their facial tattoos called moko. They're very sacred tattoos on their bodies that they take on as part of their culture. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, we always think of tattoos as being a kind of an act of rebellion or a counterculture tribal marking, in a sense, for modern society. But the Maori, you know, they'll check in with their grandparents before they make moko on their bodies, and they'll learn their indigenous language, and they may contemplate what the images will actually be over a period of decade or more through their lives. They may start when they're children to think about what their tattoos are going to look like. So they are really special and particular to them and have multiple meanings in their lives. And basically the photographer said, stand here and I'll just take the picture, it belongs to you. So every picture that he took, the rights belonged to the sitter. So each Maori person who agreed to walk in and just stand in front of the white background, they own the copyright, you know what I mean? Like, we have to think so much about intellectual property, but for them it's sort of spiritual property, you know, it's like taking a little bit of them. So each one of them, rather than Hans Melleman owning rights to it, each of these sitters owns rights to the pictures. And we've had a really great response from people here up in the Boston area who are tattooed or interested in being tattooed or below the age of, you know, when we're, you know, of our typical demographic, who are really excited to see it. You see, you know, guys wearing their soldier uniforms but have their faces entirely covered in tattoos, or, you know, people in suits or women nursing babies who are tattooed on their faces with the beautiful chin tattoos that women receive. So we're really proud of that one too. And one of the things I like to tell people about the museum is that no matter, even if you think you're not interested in art, I can find something in the museum that you will love that will completely speak to you in some way. And we try to encourage people to have a really personal, transformative experience in the museum. We actually talk about that on our meetings, and we think about it every day.
Mm. So you have, like, You have already, like, all the plans for, like, next year?
Yeah, we definitely do. We try to, like most museums, we try to plan a couple of years out, sometimes more. And we have some really incredible things coming up this coming year. There's a big show of contemporary Chinese art. We'll be the only place in the East Coast that will have this show. It's called Mahjong, Contemporary Art in China. And it's 40 years of contemporary artists doing what they do in China. And, you know, it's not exactly the past 4 years in China, as you may know, haven't been the most open, perhaps. So a really wonderful collector named Yuli Sig, who has a really long, he's a Swiss businessman and diplomat who's had a really long, deep connection with China, started collecting before anybody else really thought to. I mean, he talks about having to go down the back alleys and find the artists where they worked, you know, to start negotiating for pieces. He put together this incredible collection, one of the best and biggest in the world, and has always planned on giving it back to the Chinese people when a good museum or a good place for them is constructed and put into place. But in the meantime, it's traveling the world, and it'll be here soon. And we're going to mix it up with our historic collections of Chinese art. We've been here for 200 years. We've been trading with China for 200 years, so we have a lot that we can play with. So you'll see really contemporary, crazy sculptures, like in the same gallery as really old, delicate porcelain pieces, and there'll be little surprises all over the museum along the way. Mm. We also have a couple of really wonderful photographic exhibitions. This wonderful, wonderful photographer is going to have her first museum show here. Her name is Jody Sternbach, and she's done an exhibition called Surfland, and she likes to use really old photographic techniques to capture modern situations and people and places. So she's taken these gorgeous pictures of surfers with a tintype camera, and you know, basically this means that there's one shot, there's one plate. You're using a technique that was used in the 19th century in the Civil War in war zones, where they had to carry big carts of toxic materials and things out into the field. And she's made these beautiful, really nostalgic, poignant-looking prints of, you know, really modern people dressed in their wetsuits or whatever that seemed like they came from another time, just right, because of the technique she used. And they're delicate and unique, each one. Mm-hmm. We also have the wonderful Valerie Bellin coming here. She's really big in Europe and just coming to be known here. She's done these amazing photographs of men and women and mannequins, and they're wonderful because you can't always tell if they're human, you can't always tell if they're mannequins, you can't always tell if they're men or women. They're just these wonderful, gorgeous faces, and you're left to sort of have a reaction with it. Is it alive? Is it something else? Is it boy? Is it a girl? I don't know. And you have this really interesting sort of unsettling interaction with these really beautiful, really beautiful people, and they're of large format, so I think it'll make a huge impact on people.
Okay. I'm just going to break for 1 second to find out. No, I'm curious, like, all right, who's, because I have this, like, sort of time, but who do I have calling in, by the way? Who's?
Oh, this is April Swiconek. I'm the...
No, I mean, there's somebody else.
Oh, there's somebody else, though. I can't see them where I am.
No, they just called in. So who is, hello?
Hello?
Yeah, who do I got there?
This is Art Hennessy, and I was in the Christmas Carol.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'll be right with you in a little while. I just want to let you know that I know you're there, okay?
Okay.
All right, hang on.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Sometimes what happens is that when I get callers and they don't realize that I see phone numbers, you know, and they have to kind of hang, you know. Because it's not like somebody answers the phone. You know what I mean?
Yes, definitely.
Like,
you can't see who it is. So.
Yeah, and I can't, and I don't know who I miss because
live radio is fun because you never quite know what's coming.
Oh, yeah, that's what's so cool
time.
About it. You never know what the hell's going to go on here. Who's coming on and what you're going to talk. Well, I usually know what I'm going to talk about. But do you have a website?
We do. It's really easy. It's PEM.org, PEM.org. And
okay.
Go there and check us out.
Okay, great. And then they can see the calendar of events, I guess.
You can see the calendar. You can see images of what we have here and what's coming up. And you can, if you're anywhere remotely near the Boston area, you can easily get to us. We're 17 miles from Boston. We're like going from Manhattan to Brooklyn. It's 5 train stops from from Boston to Salem, just on the commuter train. It's ultra quick. And if you haven't been here for a while, if you're in the area, we hope you'll come. And if you're in New York and you come north, it'd be great to see you.
Cool. All right.
Thank you so much for talking with me. It's really fun to have these chats. Thanks.
Yeah, it is. I may have you, chat another time.
Anytime about anything we've got.
Okay. I really appreciate it, April.
Hope you'll come visit us sometime.
Oh, yeah. I did.
Oh, yes. I heard you were in town, and we didn't
I did
know.
I
the whole
on
thing.
The last, yeah, on the last press, on this press trip in November.
Well, come see us, and we'll show you around personally and take
the,
you lunch.
The disastrous home. Press trip in November.
Oh, I'm
but
so
I did
sorry.
See,
I heard it was from hell.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. But,
sorry about that.
But the one thing, we did go there, and the one thing that I made sure, it's interesting because of the things that were there, I wanted to make sure that I saw the Chinese house.
Oh, did you see in your tongue? Oh, I'm so
yeah,
glad
I wanted it because I wanted to see something that I thought would be the most unusual thing to see.
Well, it is unique in all the continents. So, I mean, there are other bits and pieces of Chinese architecture here and there, but I don't think there's anyone who's got a whole home that's just been brought with everything in it,
right?
Plunked down next to a museum. But if you come back, we'll take really good care of you.
Okay. Okay. Thanks so much, April.
Take care, Merle. It's been fun.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Let's click. I got to click you on here. Okay. You're on the air now. All right. Introduce yourself. Go ahead. Yeah.
And, well, you probably know me last night as Mr. Fezziwig. I was Scrooge's old boss when he was in the past. And I heard you were at the party last night. For Fezziwig's old warehouse.
Oh yeah.
And yes, I called in earlier at the beginning of the show. I was on hold, but then I actually had to go on.
And now I'm
actually in between scenes. So you're really getting a behind the scenes look at the show here because I'm actually driving to the next scene in the graveyard. So
really?
I don't know if you had a chance to explain to your listeners at all about the show.
I wanted to tell us like what the particular, like because they do different trolley tours. So tell us about this particular one.
Well, what this is a very interactive, lively sort of improvisational version of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and it also incorporates a lot of the streets and the sites of Salem with it, and what it is the audience takes a journey with Scrooge through the tale of the Christmas Carol. You meet him at the beginning, and you ride a trolley with him through the streets of Salem as he interacts with you and tells the story, and he meets the three spirits at different sites, and we end up, with Scrooge it's quite a different changed man by the end, and we hope the audience usually has a good time too.
Now, as far as the stops, now where was the first? Well, I got there a little late because we were busy eating at that wonderful restaurant. So in the middle of dessert, we had to leave, but we did return for dessert again. But anyway, so I didn't get to. There was that the first place. What was the first place that we walked into?
That was the shop where Scrooge starts,
right.
Do you mean where you actually started the show?
Yeah, where
Bob Cratchit works.
That was
a gift shop called Salem Dippity, down
that's
on Pickering Wharf.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a gift shop where we start the show, and we started it there 4 years, actually. The show's been running for probably about 20 years, and it was started by Eric Rodenheiser, whom you saw play Scrooge, I think, last night.
Mm-hmm.
And he started it as a one-man show, and he would go around to all the places, and he would simply hit a tape recorder with which he had recorded voices, and the audience would listen to voices telling the story at the different locations. And then as the show gained popularity, he started adding actors, and now we have a cast of 9, and we all play different roles. You probably... hopefully you didn't pick up too well on that as we were going around, but we try to disguise ourselves pretty well. But we do play multiple roles. And it starts at Salendipity, which is a gift shop down on Pickering Wharf, which is, you know, a pretty famous place. It's right near the Custom House where Nathaniel Hawthorne used to work. And it goes, proceeds through the streets to the old Masonic Temple on Line Street, where we go in, and it's sort of converted into a theater now, and that's where Christmas Past is. Then they go to the old...
Is that the one they call Griffin Theater?
That's right, the Griffin Theater, and that's Eric Rodenheiser's theater. And
Not Merv Griffin. Right,
it's named after his son, Griffin, actually. So the symbol is a griffin, as in G-R-Y-P-H-O-N, but it's spelled Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-E-N. And then the trolley, you know, that's where Christmas Past is, and then the trolley takes the audience onto the Salem Inn, which is another old building in Salem, with historic significance. And that's where you see Bob Cratchit's house, and you look at Christmas Present with the spirit there. And then we go on to the Witch Burial Memorial, which is in right in the heart of Salem there. And that's where the really old cemetery is. And that's where we meet the ghost of Christmas yet to come. And he shows Scrooge his future, which is not too pleasant, and then you board the trolley and you end up back where you started, down on Pickering Wharf. And the whole show takes about an hour and 10 minutes, and we've been doing it for years. We do 2 to 4 shows a night, depending on the nights, and we race all around Salem as the actors backstage.
Well, I must say, it was very comical. It was really, extremely entertaining, you know, and you have to catch the lines, especially.
And Scrooge is very, very in your face, isn't he?
yes, quite.
but it sounds like you can take it.
it's fun because it's a lot more interactive.
Mm-hmm.
Done this way. And also what I thought was really, it's not the word cute, but that works nicely, is you make sure that the children are used, that children that are on the trolley are used.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a great way in having them, you know, sitting at dinner, at the Christmas dinner.
That's right. At the Cratchit House, the children actually become the Cratchit's children.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was that was a great idea. And
however, we do usually choose the largest audience member to be Tiny Tim.
Yes, I thought that was hilarious. So it's not just like I want people to know it's not just hearing the tale, but it's extremely entertaining. You know, it's like a piece of living theater kind
mm-hmm.
of pizza, you know, a living theater versus theater that's like on one stage.
That's right. And it really, really adds to the story because when the audience sort of goes along with the story and becomes part of the story and interacts with the story, you really journey with Scrooge through the story, and so you really develop sort of an investment, the audience does, in the show, and so we find that people really, you know, get involved, and they have a great, like you said, it is fun, they have a great time, and people really love it. It becomes a tradition for a lot of families. We have families who've been coming for decades. Now they come every single year, they really enjoy it quite a bit, and it is just fun. It's a fun show.
And I would imagine that because of being able to throw in lines and joke, it's not the same show every time.
No, there's certain parts that we keep pretty free of the jokes because they're pretty serious. But but you're right. We can change things. We can add things. You know, Scrooge especially. He's very interactive with the audience going around. But the spirits joke around quite a bit. They'll add some things in there and joke with the audience and with Scrooge. And we can add in contemporary references every now and then. And we add new things every year, too. So, you know, whether it be a new costume or a new character or things like that. So it changes a little bit every year because, like I said, it is an institution for a lot of people, and they come back, so we like to give them some changes as well.
So, by the way, what I also thought was hilarious, but this is my sense of humor. While we were at the memorial, is that what it was?
Yes.
And the ghost of was Ghost of Christmas Present? Is that what the
future? You mean future. The big scary guy? Yeah.
Yeah. And what was hilarious is it just this one particular gesture, like, you know, Scrooge is talking to him and he's like going, "I don't talk," you know.
and they play charades sort of, and they he gestures with his hands and so. He actually sometimes has more character than the people who can talk.
Now, aside from this particular tour, do you do any other? Do you go on any other of the trolley tours?
Myself, no. This is actually, I'm an actor. I've been with the show probably about 11 years. And I have, I just do this show up here with the trolley. But I also, in October, tell ghost stories aboard the Friendship, which is the big ship that you maybe saw off of Derby Wharf there, the big old sailing ship that they have down there. And I tell ghost stories there. But this is the only thing I do with the trolley. So,
So you tell ghost stories, huh?
Yeah, we do. it's a show that they do, the Salem Theater Company does every year down there for October. So, but the trolley tour, this is a real hot ticket here in Salem. So it's good. I'm glad you got to come on it.
Oh yeah, I'm glad too, because when I was there last month, I went on a regular trolley tour.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So this one, you know, what I call, you know, tourist trolley tour, so you can see, you know, get acquainted with Salem, that kind of thing. And I thought that was great. But so this was like completely different, and I really enjoyed it. But, so when is your next show? At 8 o'clock?
Actually, I'm going to have to leave you now because we're still in the midst of the first show, and I'm about to go on for my second scene in probably about 10 seconds. I'm in the graveyard. I'm standing in the graveyard right now talking to you. And you know what? I'm standing right next to the Ghost of Christmas Future, and hold on a second. He has something to say to you. That's right. He doesn't talk. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay.
That's great. Yes. Oh, thank
all right.
You so
well,
much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. And people who are interested, they can either look up the Salem Trolley online, or they can look up Griffin Theater online, and they should be able to get to it that way.
Okay.
Thank
Let's
you
do
so
it.
Much, Mo.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
That was a hoot. That really was a hoot. So, now, let's see. This is a very confusing evening, so I'm going to have to ask, who do I have on the line?
It's Tony from 62 on Warfare.
Oh, Tony. All right. Yeah, let me take a, no, I won't take a break. Nah, I was going to, but you know what? I want to talk about that fabulous food.
Well, thank you.
Especially because, see, I have somebody who's listening to the show, you know, who is probably, like, starving because, okay. But I want to talk about, introduce yourself.
Okay. I'm Tony Betancourt, the chef owner of 62 on Wharf. We're a modern Italian Mediterranean restaurant in Salem, Mass. And we've been open for less than a year. You know, we opened in February. And, you know, that's pretty much it. That's the introduction.
Okay. So what I want to do is, I don't know what I did with the menu. I don't have it in front of me. I mean,
okay.
it's not as if I can't recall the food, because, see, in recalling the food, I'm recalling, like, I will relive eating each morsel. So I want to go over, first I want to kind of point out the way you have the menu that starts off with, well, instead of calling it tapas, which, you know, because there's always, you know, each one has a different type of thing. You have a, what do you call them?
Okay, well, the menu is designed like an Italian menu. You know, it starts off, it has three columns, and the first column is antipasti. But we're not strictly Italian, so you could call them tapas. They could also be, you know, Greek mezze, whatever. You know, the
right.
Interest comes from all over the world.
Yeah, small dishes.
Exactly, yeah, and
okay.
They're all priced the same. They're all $5 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause the idea is that you could come in and have those as your first course, like you did last night, and then move on to a complete meal. Or you could come in with a friend and just sit at the bar and have a bunch of the antipasti. We also have an antipasti platter, which is a mix of all of those antipasti. So it's gives people a lot of flexibility. It expands the menu exponentially based on how you want to order. You know, you're not just stuck with ordering an appetizer and an entree. You can have
mm-hmm.
the antipasti. You can mix and match. You can do a lot of different things with this menu.
So what I want to talk about is, because we had the platter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did. And
okay.
The platter,
so
you get
to tell what each of the things that
okay.
we had and describe them. To
okay,
a
there was quite
I
a
want
bit
you
on
describe
there.
Describe them. I want everyone to be able to drool.
Okay. Well, let's see. On that antipasti platter, we
yeah.
have a mix of hot and cold items, just like an Italian antipasti platter
mm-hmm.
would have. So some of the cold items that you had, or room temperature, they're not, you know, ice cold, but we have pickled mushrooms. They're, you know, trumpet royale mushrooms that are marinated with extra virgin olive oil, white wine vinegar, and garlic. We also had chickpea fritters. Those are deep-fried chickpea polenta with a date compote, and they're really spicy, kind of Moroccan in flavor with cumin and crushed red pepper, but then the sweetness from the date compote really, you know, mellows out the spice, and it goes well together. You have the hot and the sweet together. There's also...
So are you using, like, chickpea flour?
Yeah, you buy chickpea flour, and you just make it like you would make regular polenta, but using chickpea flour instead of cornmeal. And then, you know, we season it, you know, we make it with butter, we season it with crushed red pepper and cumin, and then let it cool down, and then it hardens, and we cut that out into what look like little fries, and we deep fry that.
Right.
Yeah, and it's really great because it's super easy to make. As long as you know how to make polenta, you just get chickpea flour, and that's readily available at, like, any kind of Italian market. You can find that. And then also on there we had arancini, which are deep-fried risotto balls, which were stuffed with prosciutto and fontina. It's kind of, I say they're almost like Italian French fries, basically, because even though they're little balls of risotto, they're just really easy to pop. You know, people love those. And, again, they're stuffed with fontina, so when you bite into it, you have the hot melted cheese oozing out of it and served with some ricotta salata, which is just a grated cheese over the top. We also had cauliflower fritters, which is just roasted cauliflower with Parmigiano Reggiano and some egg yolk, and just you know, just basically you mix together to make a batter, and that was deep fried, served with salsa verde, which is
now you crushed the cauliflower,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, we just roast it long enough that it's very, very soft.
Yeah.
So when you're mixing the batter together in the bowl, they just naturally fall apart.
Yeah, cause
but it's nice if it's not pureed because you get some texture.
Right. What I liked about that is, well, it's not. I mean, it it didn't taste like if you didn't know what you were eating,
mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have said, oh, this is definitely cauliflower.
Yeah, cauliflower is one of those things. You have to disguise it. So this is a good way of disguising
unless
it.
Unless you like cauliflower.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
We also had, I think there was also pesce en saor, which is a Venetian dish of filet of sole marinated with red onion, pine nuts, and currants, and it's a little bit vinegary. It's all, basically, it's pickled sole, but, you know, on a garlic crostino, so you have the garlic bread, then the sole, you know, the fish on top, which is cool. And, you know, so you get the temperature contrast and then the sole.
Did we have that?
That was on that platter, yeah. That was.
Oh, okay. Oh, I thought there was something with bacala.
Yeah, we also had the salt cod fritters as well. So we had mix of a lot of fried things, a couple of fried things and a couple of pickled things on there,
mm-hmm.
just to keep it interesting. And the bacalhau, yeah, that's salt cod mixed with potato. And that's also deep fried and served with a garlic aioli, and we make the salt cod here ourselves. We get fresh cod, we salt it, and then, you know, it's a 2 or 3 day process. But, yeah, it's something traditional. It's Portuguese. I grew up eating that kind of thing. So, yeah, we have inspiration. You know, the menu looks Italian, but we have inspiration from all over the world.
Right. And there was something with eggplant.
Yeah, the eggplant salad. It was roasted eggplant with tomato confit, which is just tomato that's cooked lightly in olive oil, as opposed to when you cook tomato to make tomato sauce. You cook it at a much higher heat for a long time until the tomato breaks down. This is just the tomato cooked in olive oil, nice and gently, so it stays whole. So the eggplant, the tomato confit, and basil, just a really simple salad. Yeah, one step away from eggplant parm, basically, if I put cheese on there.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, the beets.
Oh, yeah, roasted beets. Yeah, the unsung hero on that platter. Just roasted red beets with, you know, lightly dressed with sea salt and a nice unfiltered extra virgin olive oil and a few wedges of ricotta salata. And ricotta salata, it has the same type of texture as feta. You know, it's a little more mild, but similar. It's close enough. If you can't find ricotta salata, you just substitute feta.
Is there, like, different flavor, taste, or anything if you take beets and roast them versus, like, boil them?
Yeah, absolutely. Any vegetable is like that in the sense that all vegetables have water in them. So when you roast a vegetable, you're using that water that's inside the vegetable to cook it. So it's going to be a lot more intensely flavored, whereas if you steam it or boil it, it's going to be you're going to dilute that water. So by using the water that's naturally in the vegetable,
right.
You get a much more intense and a much stronger flavor. Not strong, not a bad strong, but beets will taste more like beets. Carrots taste more like carrots, et cetera.
What I particularly found with this is, because sometimes, like, if I'm doing it, I find that it tastes, and maybe the word rooty, too rooty,
Yeah. I describe it as tasting somewhat metallic. You almost taste metal or aluminum. Usually, to me, that happens with beets a lot if they're just a little undercooked. You know, when my cooks are making the beets, and if I taste them, I know that they're undercooked. When they taste too rooty or somewhat metallic, it just needs to cook a little longer. Depending on the size, it does take a while. You know, especially we dry roast them. We roast them on a bed of salt. So we're really pulling out all that water. We don't cook it with any water whatsoever. And
So in other words, are you like taking a pan, like a baking pan, and putting salt on it and putting the beets on it?
Right, exactly.
Are you peeling the beets before?
No, afterwards. We keep it, the peel stays on, so they're just exactly like you said, a baking pan or like a lasagna sheet pan,
mm-hmm.
something with sides, and you put, you know, maybe a quarter inch of salt, something for it to sit on,
right.
And then cover it with foil,
mm-hmm.
and then right into the oven, and we do it in an oven without a fan, a still oven for... Probably, you know, depending on the size, it probably takes an hour and a half to 2 hours for them to be fully cooked. If they're small, probably only an hour.
Right.
You know, but beads vary in size, so it's impossible for me to tell someone exactly how long it will take. But it does take a little while with that because, again, you're waiting for the – what happens is the beads are heating up, and then the water naturally present in the bead is essentially boiling, and that's what will cook the beads, and then it evaporates outward. So it's a longer process than if you had water in that pan because
okay.
that water would heat up much faster.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so and it tastes much more intense, but it's good. It just takes longer, but you do other things while you're waiting on the beets. And then when they come out, we keep the foil on the pan for maybe 15 to 20 minutes, and then it's still hot but cool enough to handle, and then you peel the beets. When they're still hot, it's much easier. If you let them cool down, it's almost impossible.
Right. Wow. Yeah. All right, now let's get to...
the next course he had pasta.
Yes. Well,
yeah.
I that pasta that I had was like first we have to tell everybody that you make your own pastas.
Yeah, absolutely. We and I chose to write that on the menu when we first opened. I didn't mention it. I just said, "Oh yeah, pasta." But now, you know, I'm very strict. I will never use boxed pasta in any restaurant setting, you know, ever. I hope to never use boxed pasta. It's just, there's nothing wrong with it. I eat boxed pasta at home all the time, but here at the restaurant, my feeling is you pay me, as the customer, you pay me to do these things.
Right.
So it might be hard, it might be difficult, but that's my responsibility. I'm supposed to do it. So we always make our own pasta, and the pasta that you had, I was so glad that you ordered
it. Please.
That's my favorite one. That's my favorite one.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, it's called Garganelli, and this is the dish that when I was building this restaurant, I couldn't wait to put this dish on the menu. I was really excited to make this for people. Garganelli are like hand-rolled penne. Basically, we cut little squares of pasta that are about, you know, slightly larger than a postage stamp, and then we have a wooden dowel. And we go from corner to corner, and we roll it around the dowel, and it ends up looking like penne. And so we do that one by one, piece by piece. But it's very relaxing, believe it or not. It's like the most relaxing job to have in the kitchen on a busy night is to be making the garganelli. And it's served with braised duck. So we get duck legs, which are really rich and, you know, pretty decadent in and of themselves, dark meat. And we braise them with red wine. But then what I add to the braise, I think, is pretty special. I add cocoa powder. So you have the richness.
Really?
We have the richness of the red wine,
uh-huh.
the richness of the meat, and then some added depth from the cocoa powder. And it just makes it, I feel like it just makes it a little more lush, a little more just over the top. And then we add dried cherries. Shallots, which are a little bit sweet. Dried cherries, also a little bit sweet. And then Tuscan kale, which is a little bit bitter. So you have a huge spectrum of flavor, in my opinion you do. You know, you have the wine, the meat,
my opinion,
the cocoa,
too.
Thank you, the cherries, and then the Tuscan kale, and then we finish it with pine nuts. You know, and it's just, to me, it's my, if I had a signature pasta dish, that's the one. I love that dish. And I love making it every single time it goes out, and it's just, I think it's pretty over the top for pasta.
I don't suppose there's a way you can send that to me, is there?
Well, you're not too far away. You just have to come back for a visit. That's
I was like, oh my God, you know. and the thing was, I mean, like, I had it. I did it as the appetizer, as a
You had it as like a mid course.
Yeah, but Katie just went ahead and did it as.
She had it as the entree.
You know,
oh, good.
But, but then I also had as an entree. Believe it or not, everybody, I continued eating.
Yeah, it wasn't over yet.
The entree had the short ribs.
Yep, you had braised beef short ribs, just over creamy polenta with root vegetables, and the root vegetables were just cipollini onions and carrots, but you know, roasted carrots and kind
right.
of glazed with a little bit of butter and sugar. As if the dish wasn't fattening enough, you know, glazing it with sugar and butter. And the short ribs over the polenta. Yeah, that's one of those dishes that, especially last night, it was so cold. here right down by the water, that's
yes.
a good comforting dish to have on a cold night like that in the winter.
What's your, I don't want to say second favorite, of the pastas that you like to make? I know that one is first.
Yeah, the Garganelli is my top. The next one that I like is pappardelle with, it's the exact opposite, the polar opposite of the Garganelli, where the Garganelli is really deep and dark and red wine. This one is a white wine dish. It's pappardelle with red wine braised duck. Rabbit. So we have rabbit with green olives and rosemary.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's the polar opposite. Like I said, the other one's very rich and deep, and this one is very brightly flavored. It has rosemary, some crushed reds, green olive, the white wine, and the rabbit, and it's tossed with pappardelle, which is just a really wide, like tagliatelle or linguine. And that one's really good. I love that one. Not too many people order it, unfortunately, because it is rabbit, and, you know, those are the breaks. Some nights it sells out, and other nights, you know, no one's interested in eating a rabbit, but, you know, whatever, it's their loss.
Yeah, well, I've had rabbit. It's funny because I had rabbit and I didn't know I was eating rabbit. And I'm, you know, as I'm eating it because it was done like coq au vin.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so I was up in Quebec, so I'm going and I'm eating it and I'm thinking it's chicken.
Yeah.
And it's coq au vin, but I'm saying to myself, but the way the foot is shaped, you know, the
it's much bonier,
it
yeah.
It was something like saying to myself, this doesn't seem like a chicken leg. It was whatever. So finally I found out, you know, that it was rabbit. Not that it, you know, made a heck of a difference in taste once you start making it like coq au vin.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
But I'm assuming, or maybe I shouldn't, that you're putting rabbit meat versus...
Yeah, we braise the rabbit legs.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very similar process to the Garganelli that you had. It's not
right.
a full leg in the dish. We braise it first, which is cooking it in liquid until it's really nice and tender, and then we pick the meat off of the leg. So we do that for the Garganelli, you know, the duck, and we do that with the rabbit. So it's not the whole leg that's sitting in the pan, just because it's being tossed with the pasta.
Uh-huh.
And makes it a little easier for people to eat it.
Do you think people, know? I mean, like if I said, oh, to you, just, you know, I pointed and say, give her this thing, you know.
Right.
And it arrived. Do you think people would know that they're eating rabbit?
They probably wouldn't know.
Yeah.
You know, I think the differences are so subtle, you know, especially now because rabbit is commercially available. Once meat is commercially available and you're not getting it on a farm or wild, it becomes so mild that they do kind of, you know, they blend right into each other. I bet people wouldn't know that it was rabbit if I chose to deceive them. But I wouldn't do that.
Okay. Now I was just curious about that.
Yeah.
So now let's get into some of the entrees. Oh, and before I do, where did you like, is this the first, I assume this is not the first restaurant you own, is it?
Yeah, this is my first.
It is.
It's not the first restaurant as a chef, but the first one as an owner.
Okay.
I worked in a town in Massachusetts called Southborough, and I was the opening chef of a restaurant called Tommaso. And it's an Italian restaurant. It was an Italian trattoria, a real traditional rustic Italian restaurant, and that's where I got the idea for this menu to be laid out in this way. We have the three sections of the menu, the antipasti or the tapas, and then the middle part of the menu is the pasta and the appetizers,
right.
And then the entrees, and that's kind of a really traditional way of eating in Italy, but I think it's great as a restaurant customer because, again, you don't have to come in have formal table service and eat an appetizer and an entree and then dessert and go home. You can linger, you can hang out, you could, you know, that pasta that you had last night was an appetizer size, kind of small.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You could have, you know, you could do two or three of those and your friend could do two or three of those and you share and now you've gotten to experience six different things on the menu. They're sized, you know, we call them common sense portions. This is not a place where you're going to come and get a full platter of pasta and then walk home, you know, take half of it home. They're sized to be, you know, eaten so that you can have two or three other things on the menu. And I think that's more exciting because you get the menu can be different for you every single time you come in.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
You came in, you had three things last night. The next time you come in, you could have three others. And you can do this multiple times in a week. That's why I like this format of the menu. It's very flexible.
Now, and by the way, in the appetizers versus
mm-hmm.
the, because you know, I just realized we skipped, because there's the first thing was the antipasti. Is that what you call the first thing?
Yep.
And the second thing is appetizers, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
And I forgot, because I was trying to remember why we didn't go into the appetizers.
I don't know. I noticed that too. You skipped right over it. You just had the pasta as a middle course and then went right to the entrees.
I'm sure it was probably because, like, how much can I eat, you know, but...
Yeah.
What was in the appetizers? What things are in the appetizers?
Well, in the appetizers, we have a salad on the menu, so that's in there. We have it's a nice. I love this salad. It's wild arugula with prosciutto, roasted almonds, and dates. And when we're making the salad, we roast the almonds to order, so they come out hot with the dates. So we roast both the almonds and the dates, and they're nice and hot. Then we toss it with the prosciutto and the wild arugula, and then we slip a few pieces of manchego into the salad, a Spanish type of cheese, and it's dressed with a sherry vinaigrette. And the sherry vinegar is just a little bit sweeter. You know, it still has the acid, but it's still a little bit sweeter than regular, you know, other types of vinegar. And it has a little honey in that vinaigrette as well. So the salad is probably one of my favorite dishes on the menu, too, because it's very complex. It's not just a throwaway salad. You know,
yeah.
When people come in, they look for a garden salad, and I say, yeah, we don't do that here. You know, not that I'm opposed to it, but the salad is a lot more complex than what some people might be expecting.
Yeah, I thought about that because I thought about having a salad like, well, I should have salad.
Yeah.
But I'm already having some ranchy pasta, and I'm already having some... pasta, and I would definitely have to have an entree. So I went,
right,
I don't
right.
know I could do this all. And we have some place to go.
Yeah. Well,
so,
that's true, too. You
yeah.
probably skipped that course because
yeah.
you did have, you had a schedule to keep. You had to be out of there at 7.
Right.
So that was an issue. Otherwise, if I had my way, I would have kept feeding you all night. You know, let you
if I had
everything.
My way too, you know, believe me. Now, what is the on the entrees? What's the what do you have a signature on your entree that you enjoy making?
Yeah, I have you know, two items on there. We have a slow roasted pork chop on the entrees, and it doesn't sound that exciting, but we get great pork chops from a food co-op based out of New York called Heritage Foods.
You don't get it from Pork Chops or Us, huh?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, pork chops at the supermarket are pretty painful to eat.
Yeah.
So these pork chops, they
mm-hmm.
come from a food co-op based out of New York, but the farms are all down south, like Missouri and, you know, Alabama, et cetera. So the pork... The pigs are all free range and they're out on pasture. They're walking around and they're developing the way pigs should develop, as opposed to being, you know, raised in a factory.
Right.
So the meat is much darker. They do have much more fat, and they're just really great pork chops to eat. So it's a slow roasted pork chop. These things are pretty much bulletproof. Like if you get pork chops at the supermarket and you overcook them, they're really dry and just terrible to eat. These have so much fat and so much marbling that we slow roast it in the oven, and it's almost as if you braised it in liquid. They come out so tender because all that fat melts away and the meat is so rich. You know, we do get some complaints from people like, oh, it's too fatty. And I'm like, you know, that's the way it's supposed to be. It is supposed to be fatty. But if you cook it correctly, the fat melts away.
Right.
And it's served on broccoli rabe. You know, so we have the meat is really rich and then the bitterness from the rabe. And it's served with what's called a mostarda. And a mostarda is something from, it's a condiment from Lombardy, the north of Italy. And it's fruit that's cooked in a mustard and wine syrup. So we make a syrup with white wine and sugar, and then we add mustard powder, mustard seed, you know, some other things like crushed red pepper, a little juniper, etc. So we have this mustard syrup, and we add to it cipollini onions, seckle pears, and dried cranberries. So it's might be hard to imagine, but when this comes out and it's hot and it's in that syrup and we have the onion and the cranberries and the pears and it's going over the pork chop, there is nothing better. There really isn't. It's just, it tastes like fall. You know, it's just all the fall and winter flavors, and it's a little bit spicy, a little bit sweet, and then you have the fat from the pork that kind of, the cranberries cut right through that fat, and it's just, it's an amazing dish. I love that dish, and I've been making that, some variation of that dish, you know, slow-roasted pork chop with mostarda. I've been doing that now for probably 3 or 4 years. You know, I just keep changing it based on the season. Sometimes the mostarda will be apricots and rosemary. Other times, you know, green apple. In the summer, I was doing it with green tomato. So it's a pretty versatile dish, and it's really simple. Again, the simplicity of Italian cooking or Spanish, you know, regional cooking, either one. It's just kind of a protein with a vegetable and some sort of condiment. It's not always that that typical formula, protein, starch, vegetable that we do here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so even if you have a lot to eat, you don't feel like you're dead. You know, you can still walk around. It doesn't kill you.
Well, you have to save room for dessert.
Exactly. You have to have a little bit of room for dessert.
You got
to
tell about, everybody had said to us, make sure you have the, and tell us.
Oh, the toffee pudding. That's our signature dish.
Explain it. Explain it to us.
It's not really that exciting when it's explained to you, to be honest, because people love this dessert. They go crazy for it. And I always joke around that I'm going to take it off the menu. But people email me specifically to tell me, don't take it off the menu. Even when I'm not joking, just totally unsolicited emails, don't take the toffee pudding off the menu. And it's just a traditional English dessert of sticky toffee pudding, and it's a cake. Basically, the short description, but I'll give you the fuller description, but the short description is that it's a slice of cake with hot caramel sauce over top and then a little bit of whipped cream. And for some reason, people just love that combination. But the cake itself, when we make it like a little individual cake, almost looks like a muffin. And it's just a basic cake, and it has dates in it. And that's so funny to me.
So when you said basic cake, would you consider like a white cake?
Flour, eggs, sugar, and butter. And then it has the dates added to it. And
okay, because it's a dark color.
It is dark, but that's what it comes from. But what I mean by basic is that it's just a simple flour, egg, butter type of cake with dates added to it. And then we heat that up to order. So the cake is nice and warm and hot. And then we have a little pot of the toffee or the caramel. That's always hot. That's bubbling away. And then we pour that over the cake. So you have this hot caramel. And then, of course, a dollop of homemade whipped cream. The whipped cream never comes out of a can here. It's always, you know, whipped with cream and sugar and vanilla, et cetera. And we put a dollop of that on the plate, and it just makes people happy, you know.
goodness! But we had the opportunity. Well, I was explaining that we had to come back because. We had to have the desserts. So we had to come back because we were in the middle of going to the trolley. But we had you make your own gelato.
Yes, we do.
Which was really nice. And then I assume you like different gelatos each time, you know. Yeah.
You know, right now, because we don't have a pastry chef, I'm the one doing all of the desserts. So we kind of keep it streamlined. Right now we just have two types of gelato, a vanilla and a cinnamon, and they actually go on a particular dessert. Like the vanilla goes on the brown butter tart, and the cinnamon goes on an apple tart that we have. So we don't make a full range of different flavors. We can, and I'm not opposed to doing it, but right now we just have those two, but they do change seasonally as the desserts change.
Right.
So if some other dessert comes up and I decide to garnish it with sorbet, but we always have it available. People sometimes ask for gelato just for their dessert as opposed to anything else. So, yeah, that's fine. We can always do that.
And there was that hot chocolate.
And then we had the hot chocolate. Yeah, that's the dish that no one – I want people to feel about the hot chocolate the way they feel about the toffee pudding, but no one seems to get it. I'm misunderstood, I think, with this hot chocolate.
So describe how you do it.
The hot chocolate is just, to me, it's just great hot chocolate. We heat, we warm the milk and a little bit of cream, of course, with real vanilla. You know, we scrape the vanilla pod and we put it right into the milk and sugar. So we have milk, cream, sugar. When that's nice and hot, we just take, you know, bulk chocolate, just Calibau, you know, nice European type of chocolate that we break up, and we throw it right in the milk, and we just wait for it to melt, and then we have hot chocolate.
That's some way to have chocolate. Yes.
I guess so. I guess that's a good way to have hot chocolate.
And then you throw in, now, are the marshmallows, like, do you make the marshmallows?
Yeah, we do. We make, right now, the way it is on the menu, we serve the hot chocolate with something called bombolino, which are little Italian beignet. They're like fried dough. And we toss that with cinnamon sugar.
This is definitely a sugar shock.
Yeah, a little bit. A little. And, you know, that way, because I'm trying to figure out what will make people buy this hot chocolate, because we used to serve it with the homemade marshmallows. And last night, I gave you the double whammy. You got the beignet, you know, the bombolino, and I cut the marshmallows and put them in the hot chocolate. So you had little miniature homemade marshmallows in your hot chocolate. I'm just trying to figure out what do people want with their hot chocolate. You know, I figure it's almost like a take on the Spanish churros, because the Spanish culture has churros, which are fried like a fried dough, and you dip that into.
Well, the
hot
one thing that I thought you. Because are you putting sugar in the milk?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so it's not exactly like the Spanish churros.
No, the reason I'm asking is what I found is that because you're putting in the Calibau and because you're putting maybe the marshmallows and you're putting in something else that's got sugar, that maybe not putting sugar in the milk.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a good
try that,
call.
You know.
Yeah, we should. Maybe
but then
it's
I,
rotting
I,
people's teeth. Like, this is too sweet.
Yeah, I want to make sure, because we only have a few minutes.
Okay.
I want to make sure that the website, what is the website?
The website is 62, either spelled out, 60, spelled out, plus the number 2, on Wharf, wharf.com. But you can also get it with the number 62, just 62, on Wharf.com. And we're in Salem, Mass. You know, so if you hit you know, Salem, Mass restaurants, we come up as well, and we're on Google. And
is the menu online as well?
The menu is online. The menu changes frequently, so I always encourage people to check online, but also just come in and have an open mind. You know, because things change.
Okay. Well. I got 2 minutes left to go. So I want to thank you for coming on. And
well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I can't wait to get off and eat dinner now.
Oh, well, I'll see about sending over a Garganelli in the mail or something like that.
God, I would absolutely like drool over. I mean, that is that was so really. That's and the funny thing is, I just quickly want to say, I totally forgot that I was eating duck, and I was eating. I'm going. This is really good. What is this? And then later on, oh, right, it was duck. Oh, that's why it was so good.
Oh,
but
good.
Anyway, okay. It says I got a minute to go, so I have to leave you.
Okay.
And I appreciate you calling in. And now you get to save this this interview for whatever you want.
Well, thank you very much, Merle. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay. Thanks
thank
a lot.
You.
Have a great evening and have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, bye, Tony.
Bye-bye.
Oh, yes, I know. So, I know, Barbara, but I'm hungry, too, after listening to this. But anyway, I don't remember, I don't know what other callers were trying to call in. I apologize if I didn't catch you. I saw another phone number on, but anyway. So, I'm going to leave you right now. And next week, we'll get onto all the witch kind of stuff, you know. And I just it'll be quite an interesting thing, as I'm having my psychic do a reading tomorrow, and we'll talk about that as well. So anybody regarding this weekend, anybody celebrating Hanukkah, have a happy Hanukkah, and sing Rock of Ages, and I have a little dreidel. I'll find some songs. So have a great day, night, or whatever, everybody. And I'll try to end it, well, here's a little bit.